to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. It's your slice of gaming life from Tokyo. I'm your host, Mono, and in 2022's final episode, I'm chatting about video game localization with experienced localization director Jennifer O'Donnell. We talk all about the journey games undergo from one language to another and the future of this fascinating industry. In the games, I revisit some Nintendo Switch titles that got DLC these past few weeks. Golf for Nintendo Switch Sports, Splatoon 3's big 2.0 update, and even more Mario Kart 8 tracks. And I'll give my thoughts on the latest news from Japan and elsewhere. Let's jump right into the feature on game localization with Jennifer O'Donnell. This episode's feature is all about game localization, the process of not only translating a game, but adapting it for a completely new market. Joining me to chat about how our favorite games are brought from one language to another and everything else that entails is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jennifer O'Donnell. I'm a Japanese to English translator slash localization director, and I work in video games.
Thanks for joining me today. I guess we should start from square one. Why did you want to get into game localization?
I didn't actually want to get into game localization at first. I originally planned to use my Japanese skills to work for a Japanese company because I had the impression that, you know, working in games or in media in general just didn't pay. And it was honestly just through a series of fortunate events where it just kind of happened that way. I never did JET. I was never an English teacher. And I was lamenting one day on Twitter how I'd love to live in Japan someday, but maybe today wasn't the day. And a friend of mine, a mutual on Twitter, said, hey, this company in Japan are hiring. Why didn't you apply? And I applied for them and got the job and moved to Japan within like 6 months. And I'm really glad I did because it worked out amazingly well.
Let's get into the steps of game localization, the process of what people actually need to do to make a great localization. Outside of language ability, what kind of skills does a localization director need?
Localization director isn't just translation. It's sort of managing a large group of people, managing kind of the localization of a project from start to finish. It's kind of a mixture of translator, project manager, editor, planner, sort of all these things mixed together. So outside of language ability, a localization director really needs patience, humility, time management, and just general organization skills.
Yes, it seems similar to more of like a project manager role than just a translator.
Yes, for sure. And there's also like depending on the company and the role itself, because they always vary differently between companies and projects. You also have to do like interpreting, sort of go to events or act as sort of a guide to Japanese staff members if you're traveling abroad.
What surprised you most about the localization process when you entered the field?
Probably the lack of clarity from linguistic service providers, or we call them LSPs, both as a, because I started working as a freelance translator for 4 years before moving in-house. And as a translator, they really don't tell you anything. And then moving in-house to the client side, I realized that even if we give them a lot of information, they don't tell us anything about their end either. So sort of the middleman is kind of a black box and you don't know exactly what they're doing, but you hope that they're doing a good job. And I think that probably surprised me the most.
Yes, I think there's a long history of maybe gaps between different parts of the translation process. Like, for example, in the 90s, like even big companies, they would just kind of send the game to like the translation house, and they would have to sort of hack into the game just to even see the script of it.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a holdover from that era when, because they're external companies, they're like, we're hiring you for a job, do the job and send it back. And so that's kind of the attitude that's taken from people.
Right.
But now that more people are learning about localization and people are talking about how it's done a lot more, I feel like it's no longer as much of a black box as it used to be. And that's putting more pressure on LSPs and, you know, localization agencies to pick up their game almost, because people are more aware of what the process is in general and sort of best practices and healthy wages and healthy working hours and that kind of thing.
So localization has changed a lot throughout the years, but how has technology changed localization? What are some of the vital everyday tools that localizers use?
I would say for sure CAT tools, computer-aided translation tools, which are softwares that just help you translate. They're not machine translation. Machine translation is very different from CAT tools. CAT tools help you organize your files. They can contain translation memories, which are previous translations for similar works. So you can easily see how you translated something in the past, especially if it's a big video game and you're like, wait, what did I translate? How was this translated several months ago? Or if you have a lot of people working on the project, how did they translate it? And so CAT tools really aid in making sure the translation is consistent and accurate and, you know, to the highest possible quality, which is vastly different from how machine translations work.
What about Microsoft Excel? Is that an important program to use for translation?
Oh, yes. Yes, a lot of companies still use Excel. And I think that's how most translation agencies will use CAT tools. But they feed Excel into it, translate using the CAT tool, and then it exports Excel, which then gets sent back to the clients. And I don't think it's as popular in the West, but in Japan, at least, Excel is still used by a lot of video game companies as their kind of database, even in terms of like the game text database, as sort of a base program because it's so flexible in its use. So I'm really glad that we have CAT tools now so we don't have to translate directly into Excel, because translating directly into Excel, which is not designed to deal with, you know, script writing, Excel is pretty important, but I'm really glad I don't have to translate directly into it too much.
I think in general, no matter where you work in Japan, Excel mastery is like a very useful skill.
Yes. Yes, that's a very good point. It is.
What do you think is the key difference between a good localization and a great localization?
I think there are two different levels to this. One is on the translator and editor level, where amazing writing skills really makes a difference between a good localization and a great localization. And the other is on a company level, where communication, flexibility, and trust are really, really important. As I said, sort of translation agencies can be a bit of a black box. And so both the localization agency and the translator and the company that's hiring the localization agency needs to have good communication and have, you know, a good schedule where you can be flexible and to trust everybody involved in the process. And when you have that balance between all three, between translator, agency, and client or company, you get much better localizations.
What's the most common issue in a localization project, and how is it typically overcome?
I think kind of going off what I was just saying is lack of communication is definitely the most common issue. Both between the developers and the localization agency, if the developers haven't really worked with localization before, they don't know what the localization company needs. And the localization company often, they don't really want to say no or kick up a fuss with the developers because they're scared that they'll lose a potential client. And so when you have poor communication from the start, that's never really a good place to kind of build off of, which then results in poor communication between the localization agency and the translators. And if there's poor communication there, then the translators aren't going to know how, you know, to handle the translation. Or if the text is a mess, or if the files don't make any sense and there's no references, it just makes for an overall more difficult project to work on and an overall lower quality game as well. You need good project managers who are aware of how things operate on all sides, both as translators and working for localization agencies and for developers. And those project managers who are really good at communicating and are aware of everything that's going on and who work really hard to make sure everybody knows what they're doing honestly makes such a huge difference. If you are a translator and you have a nightmare project manager, then that often drives people to stop working with that agency.
How does game localization differ from localizing other Japanese media like novels, anime, and manga?
I think in video games, there's a lot more people, a lot more moving parts, and a lot more money involved. Novels, anime, manga all tend to be localized into one language at a time, unless you're Netflix. And as a result, publishers don't often need to worry about too many moving parts. Normally, they send out the text, and then they get it back, and then they'll send it to an editor, and then they'll get it back. And it's kind of more of a conveyor belt process, sort of going from one person to the next person to the next. And so again, there's not much communication between all the parties involved in the localization. But that's not the case with every single publisher in the West. But it, from my experience, it tends to be the case. Whereas in video games, you have everybody involved in the development. The projects themselves tend to be a lot bigger. A lot more money in general is involved in both the creation and when the game gets released, they tend to make a lot more money than manga and anime.
Right.
On that level, it's very different. And I think because of that, it creates a very different system in terms of how people work with video games.
Let's dig into the Japanese language a bit. Are there any recurring Japanese phrases that you find tricky to translate or localize? I often hear that, for example, shikata ga nai is really prickly to translate.
I feel like shikata ga nai isn't that difficult to translate. It's just the best example to give people who are not familiar with how translation works. Because translation varies drastically depending on the context and the translator, often because it's not just words you're translating, but it's the meaning and the intent behind what's being said. And so I think because of that, set phrases are honestly a lot easier to translate because they're set phrases, and an experienced translator has come across them a lot. Or even if you just read a lot of media, you probably would have come across a number of set phrases quite frequently. Oh, honestly, I think the most difficult thing to handle is vague context. The other day I translated something and the Japanese was like, "Kare ni korosareru." And it was like, who? What? Who's he? And I ended up translating it as, he's going to kill them. But then I found out it was actually, he's going to kill me. And that, that without context, that kind of thing is completely lost. And so that's honestly, I think, the most difficult, well, not difficult. That's the trickiest part, is trying to gauge the context without being told what the context is. Sort of, you start to learn how to read between the lines.
What's something about the Japanese language that excites you when you're translating it into English?
Honestly, I think it's also this, because of the lack of context, reading, the action of reading between the lines and imagining the scene is what I definitely enjoy the most. Sort of picturing how the characters or how the story is playing out, how the scene is playing out, and people's relationships with each other, and kind of picturing that in my head and then thinking, okay, how do I get this picture that's in my head into the picture, into the head of the people reading this? Obviously a lot easier with video games because you have the scene in front of you. But still, if you're a freelance translator, you need to be able to imagine this because you might not necessarily have the game in front of you as you translate. So I think that's both most the trickiest thing and the thing that excites me the most is how do I get this scene? How do I paint this into the target audience's mind? How do I convey this same feeling that I'm getting when I read the source Japanese?
What do you perceive as the future of game localization? How do you imagine localization projects will be changed in 10 years?
I honestly think this depends on the choices of key individuals in the industry. The worst case scenario is that in 10 years, we'll have a lot more companies working with machine translation, which will create a drop of quality in terms of writing as language service providers look to the localization industry agencies look to increase profits, and game developers look to cut costs. If we have more people who you know, pursue that avenue, then we'll see a larger increase in machine translation, which I hope won't be the case because it doesn't create good game writing.
Right.
But on the other hand, you have a lot more developers who are, you know, developing their internal localization departments and their teams, and they're the ones that really see value in good quality localization, such as, you know, the big companies such as Square Enix and Nintendo. And so they're really driving home the importance of good quality localization by nurturing, you know, their departments in-house and kind of building up their own teams and expanding and pushing out more and more games because they know that good quality localization drives sales. And I think also because of that, we're seeing a lot more people talk about localization and more information about it is more accessible than ever, which is helping to improve localization in general because freelancers can learn from other people's mistakes and, you know, read all these articles or listen to podcasts and learn more about the industry as a whole. And so their quality also is increasing. So I think in 10 years, I'm hoping that we're going to see a higher quality in terms of localization, not just in English, but in other languages as well. Arabic and Chinese are huge markets that are still in their kind of prime. They're kind of at the stage where English was in the 2000s. So, you know, there's a huge potential there, but the localizations tend to be kind of, they're clunky. They haven't, you know, learned from other people's mistakes.
Right.
And so I think in 10 years, we're going to see a huge improvement in quality in Arabic and Chinese. And maybe we'll even start seeing other industries pop up, especially in Africa and Southeast Asia as well. So I'm optimistic.
What advice do you have for people trying to get into game localization?
I think game localization isn't a job you can enter straight out of college or university. It takes a lot of time to build up the experience and knowledge, not just about, you know, language, but also about a wide range of subjects. I think it's really important to sort of develop the hobbies and the things you're interested in personally and to follow the things you love and definitely drive to keep learning about language and localization industry as a whole. But definitely hobbies and general interest because you never know what will come in handy. I know people who they really like guns, like not firing them, but just guns in general. And thanks to that, they have a really good understanding of how the language of gun works.
Right.
Which is great when you're working in video games that have a lot of guns and you have to talk about the different pieces or about the different verbs used with those actions of firing or reloading. Or some people who are really into photography can utilize that knowledge in video games for like the photo modes, or if you have a video game that's all about photography, or just like it's really crazy how really asinine knowledge can come in handy when working on video games. And it can be a boon because, hey, you know a lot more about Gundam than somebody else, and so you're probably more equipped to localize a game about Gundam than somebody else's.
Right.
And so, yeah, definitely follow the things that you love and you're interested in and be prepared to keep learning because it's a career where you're never going to stop learning something new.
If you could go back in time and work on the localization of any retro game, what title would you choose?
I would choose any. I wouldn't want to go back in time because back in the 2000s or the 90s is when we didn't have cat tools and we didn't have the technology. And it means I would have to translate a game without seeing it, have a strict character limit, maybe like 20 characters per text box.
Yes.
And have to work in something like Excel or even write out bug reports on a fax in pencil. Which I've heard from someone that I know, they had to do that in the 2000s.
Oh, wow.
So I'd rather not go back in time. But if I could translate a retro game with modern cat tools and with an expanded UI, and I wouldn't say no limitations, but you know, the modern technology and UI that's available to us, then I'd probably like to work on something like Final Fantasy IX or Final Fantasy IV, one of the Final Fantasies, because they're a lot of fun. And yeah, I really like the Final Fantasy series.
All right. Well, I'm glad I got to chat with you about game localization. So Jennifer, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Jen Translations, J-E-N Translations. I also have that on Instagram and on Hive, but those are both very new accounts. Or you can find out more about localization and about translation in general on my website, j-entranslations.com.
Great. And listeners, the links to everything will be in the podcast description. Jennifer, once again, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
Once again, thanks to Jennifer O'Donnell for chatting with me about game localization. Be sure to follow her on social media. The links are in the description. Instead of releasing a new game in December, Nintendo decided to instead release major updates to their evergreen titles. We've got three big ones: Splatoon 3's 2.0 update, golf being added to Nintendo Switch Sports, and Wave 3 of the new Mario Kart 8 Deluxe tracks. I'm going to talk about all of them, but first let's look at Splatoon 3 since I think that one is the biggest and most exciting of the updates. On December 1st, Splatoon 3 got its 2.0 update, aka Chill Season 2022. There are new weapons, maps, items, the addition of Big Run, something I've been looking forward to for a very long time. Table Turf Battle isn't online yet, but that might come at a later update. There are three new weapons, 10 variants of existing weapons, 75 pieces of gear, 48 locker decorations, new banners, new emotes. Basically, everything in the game just got more of it. I tried out all the new weapons. The first one is Splattershot Nova, which is similar to the Splattershot Pro. It's long range, yet the damage is pretty weak. Actually, the damage output is the exact same as the Arrow Spray, which is not known for KOing your opponents. It has a really fun design. It kind of looks a bit futuristic, and the black part looks like an octopus tentacle kind of wrapping around the ink tank. This seems more suitable for harassing and support play instead of just, you know, being Rambo. Like the Splattershot Pro, I much prefer the normal Splattershot. There's also a Big Swig Roller, which is a, you guessed it, a new roller. It comes with Splash Wall and Ink Vac, which is a fun special. It takes up quite a lot of ink, but it is more high speed than you would expect. I can see this being useful in Salmon Run due to its high speed. However, ink management can be a killer in that mode, so it might be a risky weapon to use. I think the most interesting weapon they added is the Snipe Rider 5H, which is a charger, aka a sniper. Again, I'm not really a sniper guy, but this one has a cool gimmick to it. And it looks like a pencil, which is a really funny idea. It can charge up and hold 5 shots, so you don't just shoot it and then you have to recharge from scratch. For example, you charge, you shoot once, and you still have 4 shots left. However, when you're moving, you're kind of strafing, so your movement speed isn't that great. This is more of a mid-range sniper, so I can see it being more of a support weapon instead of just somebody who sits on the top of the map and just KOs everybody. But as a mid-range weapon, I think you would want a bit more mobility, right? It has the sprinkler and the very, very useful tacticooler, so maybe there is a role for it. I can't see it being really useful in Turf War, but maybe there are some rank modes where it's very vital. So all three of these new weapons are a bit more support-type weapons. As for what other new weapons they could add in the future, I've always wanted like a bazooka type of weapon as the main weapon. Not quite as strong as the Trizooka, but something similar. The best FPS of all time, Team Fortress 2, has the Soldier class, and their main weapon is a rocket launcher. So having a rocket launcher type of weapon being the main weapon in Splatoon 3 would be a really interesting idea, and I'm hoping they go that direction in the future. The kit mix-ups, we got the Tentatech Splattershot with Splat Bomb and Ink Strike. I'm a big Splattershot fan, but I think I prefer the normal Splattershot compared to the new Tentatech one. The new maps, we have Brinewater Spring and Flounder Heights. Brinewater Springs is based on an onsen, and it's shaped kind of like an S. It is the smallest map, and by quite a large margin. It's pretty crazy how quickly you can get to the enemy's base. And speaking of the bases, both of them have a lot of verticality. Both are kind of elevated, with the middle area being lower. So I think it's very sniper-friendly. If you can get a really good push on the start, you can really dominate the map, since there's not a whole lot of room to maneuver. Flounder Heights returns from the first game, and it has a similar idea to Brinewater Springs, but the opposite, where the bases are low, but the midpoint is high. Climbing mid is vital to victory. If you don't have that, well, you're going to lose, because that gives them a height advantage and it lets them easily navigate to your base. Getting to mid has a lot of access points, so even if the enemy team does take over, it's not the end of the game. You can easily rout them or come up from behind them and take mid yourself. Both are really solid and unique maps compared to what is already in the game, but they are quite small. I know some people want the more open, wider maps, like Kelp Dome, which is one of my personal favorites, but I'm glad these new maps focus more on fighting for mid instead of the more choke-pointy stages we already have. Salmon Run got Marooner's Bay, which returns from the previous game. It looks like a shipwreck, which is a kind of a cool aesthetic, but it's really just another map. I kind of want to see Ruins of Arc Polaris return from Splatoon 2, but hey, anything is better than Spawning Grounds, right? And speaking of Salmon Run, we finally got to experience Big Run, the once-a-season event where salmon attack Turf War stages. This time they attack the much-reviled Wahoo World, even though I do like that map. On paper, it seems like, well, it's just like one new Salmon Run stage for a limited time. Is that very exciting? Actually, yes. Yes, it is. The battle is very dynamic in how it changes the map. And since this map is really not built for Salmon Run, it really lets you do a lot of things you won't do in a normal Salmon Run map. For one, there's way more ways to flank the opponent, and closing off parts of the stages make you feel like this is not Wahoo World, like it's a totally new stage. It was a lot of fun, but also very, very challenging. Like, you are going to rank down, because people don't know what they're doing. The map really likes to give you new spawn points. You'll start in the middle, then you'll start in the back, then you'll start back in the middle. There's a lot of high tide, so the map really feels unrecognizable. The thing you're fighting for is a big Kohozuna statue. Depending on how many eggs you get in one match, that's ranked against the other players, and the top percentage get a gold, with silver and bronze following. I got 104 eggs, so I got a bronze. But isn't bronze and gold pretty much the same color? It's just different lighting. Honestly, I would prefer getting more scales, because that's the rarest resource in Salmon Run, but overall, it was still fun to play, even though the reward is kind of something you can't really use. I mean, the Kohozuna statue is gigantic. It can barely fit in your locker. But I am excited to see the future events, and hopefully they will throw us a scale or two. Nintendo Switch Sports finally got their golf update after 7 months. Yes, 7 months. It was supposed to come in fall, but got delayed to winter. There's actually been quite a big marketing push in Japan, with advertisements starring Yui Aragaki showing off the new golf mode. I was kind of wondering where they would fit this in the menu, because each sport has its own building, but the golf is kind of like a harbor, so the idea is that you are taking a boat to the golf courses, which is kind of clever. Golf supports 8 players, and like bowling, you all play at the same time. There are 21 courses, which is quite a lot, and a lot of them have very unique designs. I like one that is kind of shaped like a spiral, and there's also ones that are islands, so you have to hit between them. I was kind of wondering, are some of these based off of NES Golf? Because in Clubhouse Games, that golf mini game just rips off the NES golf courses. But I can't say for sure if some of these are from NES Golf or not, or even from the previous Wii games, but I'm sure some are. The controls are sensitive, but not overly so. Like, you typically won't whiff a shot unless you are just swinging like crazy. You do need to practice a bit to understand how strong you're going to hit it, but otherwise, it's pretty fair. I'm pretty satisfied with how they integrated into the game. Having everyone golf at the same time is pretty fun, since you can see everyone's golf ball go at the same place, and you can kind of get a sense of their progression. The controls are nice, and there's a lot of content here. I mean, 21 holes is quite a bit, since you typically play about 5 holes per round, as long as you don't get eliminated. I would still say bowling and soccer are my favorites, but this is a pretty good one that they added, and something a lot of people have been expecting. Though I do want them to add a bit more spicy sports in the future. There have been data mines for dodgeball and basketball, too, that I think are really interesting, especially dodgeball. I mean, golf is great, but is it really going to get people jumping back into the game who played it in April and then stopped? This is supposed to be an evergreen title for Nintendo, and it is selling quite well, but I think they need to make the updates a bit more frequent. Last but not least, we also have Mario Kart 8 Deluxe Booster Course Pass Wave 3. I always get it mixed up. Is it Booster Pass Courses or Booster Course Pass? I think they could have made a catchier name for this. But anyways, we have 8 new courses. They are in the Rock Cup, London Loop from Tour, Boo Lake from GBA, Rock Rock Mountain from 3DS, and Maple Treeway from Wii. In the Moon Cup, we have Berlin Byways from Tour, Peach Gardens from DS, Merry Mountain, which is technically from Tour, and Rainbow Road from the 3DS. Out of these, my favorite is definitely Maple Treeway. I mean, I love Mario Kart Wii, and that was one of the more standout tracks from that game, so converting it into Mario Kart 8, it's just even better. Merry Mountain is also a really nice track. It has a Christmas aesthetic, and since it is a somewhat new track, it's more similar to a modern Mario Kart one than, say, the GBA games. Though Bootleg does have a bit more verticality, like you go under the water, the SNES and GBA Mario Karts are very fun, but the maps are pretty flat, right? Because it's a 2D game, even though it's trying to trick you into being 3D. I'm really not sure what else to say about these Mario Kart 8 tracks. I mean, it's just more tracks. They've actually changed quite a bit if you want to compare it to the past games, but unless you're like a Mario Kart hardcore who knows every single turn from every single map from all the games, it's probably going to feel like, yeah, this is a fun Mario Kart map, and I remember this Peach Hedge Mage. Tracks I'm looking forward to, of course, Koopa Cape, which looks like it is going to be added in the future. So that's Nintendo's big updates for December. Nothing major, but there's a lot to play out there. I'm excited to see all three games get updates in the future, especially Splatoon 3. That's it for the games, now for the news. The last news update of the year. Honestly, in terms of news and updates, this is a nice, relaxing time. No stressing out about when the next Nintendo Direct is coming or what Nintendo could possibly release to fill out the rest of the calendar. The year is done, so just lay back and play some video games. But there were some big news tidbits these past few weeks. The biggest event, of course, was the Game Awards, Jeff Keighley's big event celebrating developers, artists, and, of course, new game announcements. Although recently, it's leaned way more into the game announcement part instead of the award part. Of course, people watch to see the new game announcements, but I think this is a great opportunity to show respect to people in the games industry. There should be way more technical awards. How about Best Animation? Or even something very specific to games, Best Pixel Art. A lot of the awards now are just kind of stolen from the Oscars, but film and games are such a different medium. Anyways, the big winner was Elden Ring taking home Game of the Year. This is From Software's second win, their first being 2019 Sekiro. In terms of new Nintendo Switch games, there weren't a whole lot, but there were some big new announcements. The biggest and most exciting for me, of course, is Hades 2. No date, but you can expect 1.0 to probably be around 2 or 3 years, maybe. Actually, is this the first Nintendo Switch 2 game to be announced? If it comes out in 2025, for example, I think Nintendo might have another piece of hardware on the market outside of the Nintendo Switch. You play as Zagreus' sister, and your goal is to overthrow Kronos. The gameplay looks pretty similar to the first Hades, the very exciting action roguelike. This is the first sequel from Supergiant Games, and I know a lot of people were a bit disappointed that they didn't jump into a new IP, but hey, Hades sold a lot. And I think the gameplay of Hades is really solid, and with a bigger budget, we can probably see a lot of new things that weren't possible in the first game. No matter what they do, Hades 2 is definitely a day one purchase for me. Nintendo's most surprising announcement was probably Bayonetta Origins, Syriza and the Lost Demon. This is another Bayonetta game, but not quite the same gameplay. It's an isometric action-adventure with a beautiful watercolor art style. Think of like a children's picture book. It's actually releasing pretty soon, March 17th. So that fills a gap in the Nintendo calendar. January is Fire Emblem, February is Kirby, March is this new Bayonetta game. We're not quite sure about April, but May is Zelda. But a January or February Nintendo Direct next year should fill out some of those gaps too. It's developed by Platinum Games and, yeah, published by Nintendo. The most surprising aspect is the price. It is a full $60 game. This definitely looks like more of a budget title from Platinum Games, something that you would sell for maybe $30 or $40. But $60? Even the main Bayonetta games are only around 10 hours or so. So hopefully this game has a lot of content to warrant the $60 price tag. Other games that are probably coming to the Switch, Earthblade by the Celeste devs, Extremely OK Games. They describe it as a 2D exploration game, aka a Metroidvania. Although exploration, that's more of an appropriate title, right? Even Nintendo decided to describe Metroid Dread as an exploration action title. So maybe we can finally get away from the Metroidvania name, although not likely. Other news, there was a new Mario movie clip. Not a whole lot here, but yeah, Illumination is putting a lot of care and detail into bringing the Mario world to life. In terms of non-Nintendo games, we have Death Stranding 2 from Kojima Productions. I was hoping that Kojima would shift to another IP, something new. But hey, games are expensive, and if you have those Death Stranding 1 assets laying around, you might as well do something with them. I actually never got around to the first Death Stranding, even though I do like Kojima's previous games. But now that Death Stranding 2 is going to be released, hey, I don't have to play that first one. From Software, not content with just winning Game of the Year, also announced a new title, Armored Core 6 Fires of Rubicon, for 2023. This is, you guessed it, the sixth game in the Armored Core franchise, at least the main franchise. Armored Core is an action game where you customize a robot, so it is not a turn-based game like Front Mission. I get all those mixed up. Like Front Mission, though, I actually have never played an Armored Core game, so I'm not that excited, but there is a hardcore fanbase that has been waiting for years for a new Armored Core title. Reading some interviews, this is not going to be a Soulsborne Armored Core game, but instead an evolution of the existing game mechanics. Either way, I think this is a great way to get people into the franchise, and it will probably have a much, much higher budget than any other Armored Core game in the past. Last bit of news from the Game Awards, Final Fantasy XVI got a June release date. I would consider myself a Final Fantasy fan. I mean, I consider 7 to be one of the best games of all time, and I've played most of them, the mainline series at least. And there are quite a lot of spin-offs I do enjoy, like World of Final Fantasy and Theater Rhythm. However, I've really dropped off of the mainline Final Fantasy titles. Not a fan of 13, not a fan of 15, I'm not into the online titles, and 16 to me, it honestly doesn't look that exciting. Square really hasn't impressed me with their shift to online action instead of the turn-based combat. I don't know why they're so scared of turn-based games. I mean, the best-selling JRPG, Pokemon, is the most vanilla turn-based game ever. Is Final Fantasy XVI going to sell 10 million copies in 3 days? I don't think so. I think the more grim, dark aesthetic also doesn't really do it any favors. I do like the more serious medieval games like Tactics Ogre, which I'm playing now, Triangle Strategy, Final Fantasy Tactics, but for a mainline Final Fantasy, I want a bit more spectacle. I want a bit more color. But I'll still keep my eye on it. And speaking of Final Fantasy, ESRB rated the Final Fantasy Pixel remasters for PlayStation and Switch. Square puts out a ton of games on PlayStation and especially on the Switch, but they really miss a lot of the easy slam dunks. I mean, where's Chrono Trigger? The Pixel remasters got quite a lot of hate when they were announced because, yeah, they messed with the graphics, they messed with the font, they messed with the music. But after release, the response has been pretty positive. It seems like a perfectly fine way to jump into the old school games. I'm a huge fan of these classic Final Fantasy games, but I've actually never played Final Fantasy V, so out of all the Pixel remasters, that's the one I'm most interested in trying out. Although the allure to replay Final Fantasy VI is always there. Mario Strikers Battle League added Birdo and Bowser Jr. in, surprisingly, their final update. Honestly, these updates haven't really been a whole lot outside of adding some characters. And even though I liked Battle League, I don't really see myself jumping back in solely to play as Birdo. I think a lot of people have been disappointed by the Mario sports games on Switch, even though they have sold pretty well. The core mechanics are very solid, but the content is just not there. Like in Battle League, you really just do the cups and that's it. There's so much you can do with the mechanics of these sports games, something fun, something creative, something wacky, but Nintendo is really expecting you to just play online. Which is fine for people who get really into it, but for me, I want a bit more meat in the single-player mode. But if you're dying for a soccer game on the Switch, maybe Battle League is the best one available. Mega Man Battle Network Collection got a date, April 14th. The physical edition will have two games on the cart with you needing to download the rest. It's $60 for the full package, or you can buy Volume 1 or Volume 2 digitally for $40 each. So yeah, it's better to buy the $60 game if you want all of them. Again, this is a pretty surprising price tag. I mean, $60 is a full price game. But there is quite a lot of content here. Each Mega Man Battle Network game is definitely at least a 20-hour JRPG. Do the math, and you have easily over 100 hours of gameplay here, which if you just play one, that will probably take you at least 20 hours, which is the same amount of length as most $60 games. I'm curious in picking it up, but I'm not sure exactly where I would start. I played Battle Network 2 on the GBA years ago and really loved it, so maybe I should just jump into Battle Network 3? Or maybe even go further than that? Now for the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This week's phrase is Kamisoko. Kamisoko. It translates to paper armor in Japanese. It refers to characters who have noticeably lower HP than everyone else. If everyone is hit by the same attack, this character will have their HP bar cut down the most. Your mages, your glass cannons, they could fall under this category. Once again, Kamisoko. And the Japanese tweet of the week. I picked one from Mario's Fun 1. It's a picture of a Santa Mario doll from the SNES era. It has Super Mario World branding on it and everything. It was only released in Japan and looks surprisingly large. It's not just one hunk of plastic, but it has cloth clothes and also a beard. Kind of funny to release a Santa Mario doll in the early 90s. Mario wouldn't don the Santa outfit again until years later in Super Mario Odyssey. As always, the tweet is in the description. That's all today. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be next year on January 1st. It's a special Game of the Year episode, so get excited. See you next time. Mata ne!